Welcome to The Record on KUOW. I'm Deborah Wong, sitting in for Bill Radke. We're live tweeting the show. You can follow us at KUOW. Every cut means that news can't get covered. That was an unnamed Seattle Times staffer speaking with The Stranger. This week, the Seattle Times announced they're reducing staff. They will offer some buyouts, and there may be layoffs. Times editor Don Shelton told the newsroom the cuts would be more significant than the last round of cuts when 15 staff members received buyouts. So what does this mean for journalism in the Puget Sound region? David Boardman worked at the Seattle Times for 30 years. When he left in 2013, he was executive editor and senior vice president of the paper. Today, he's the dean of the School of Media and Communication at Temple University in Philadelphia. David, welcome.
Thank you. It's fun to be talking to the folks back home.
Well, it's great to hear you. So what did you think when you heard this news, that the newspaper is having to cut back their newsroom staff yet again and bigger cuts potentially than last time?
Well, I have to say it's not at all surprising. I mean, this is happening at local regional newspapers and even at big national newspapers like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. It's happening all over America. It's part of a long-going trend now over the past decade in which newspapers are continuing to struggle to reinvent their business models.
So it's not surprising, but do you know anything about really what's happening at the Times right now? I know they keep their finances pretty close to the vest, but how bad is the financial position of the paper?
You know, I really don't know. And, you know, I don't know anything particular about what's happening there vis-a-vis any other newspaper in America. I mean, they're struggling with the same challenges. You know, I would say that historically, the Seattle Times, and through most of my career, the Seattle Times has had one of the larger newsrooms of any regional newspaper in the country, always above its weight in terms of both the quality of the journalism and particularly the investigative journalism that's gone on there. And that has been, you know, in large part the result of the Blessing family's commitment to keeping the newspaper staffed. And even with the cuts of the past few years, it's still far larger than a lot of regional newspapers in cities the same size or bigger. That said, you know, as that anonymous person in the newsroom said, I mean, every one of these cuts hurts the quality of the publication. There's no question on that. And I'm sure everyone pains the people who are running the newspaper.
The confusing thing for me is that since the election, we've been hearing these stories about how newspapers in the United States, major newspapers, are getting more subscribers. People seem to have been making that switch back to real journalism. Is that not the case?
Well, I think it is the case. But remember, what are we? We're a month. Exactly a month out today.
Yeah.
So, you know, 1 month is not going to reverse, you know, a decade of decline. What's happening from a business standpoint? So print advertising revenue for newspapers has, over the past year, I mean, this has been the result of years and years of decline, it dropped to its lowest level since 1950 this year, the revenue from print advertising, when the population in the United States was less than half its current size and the economy was about one-seventh the size that it is now. So, you know, as a result of that, tens of thousands of journalist jobs in print particularly and in broadcast as well have been lost all over the country, and hundreds of newspapers have shut down. Now, you know, it's not entirely bleak. Newspapers have found that people really do value quality content. The price that subscribers pay for the newspaper is far greater than it was historically. Historically, the business model was you practically gave the paper away for a dime or a quarter, and that was all about just providing an aggregated mass audience to advertisers. Over time, with the advent of the internet and Craigslist and Monster and all the other ways there were to reach consumers, advertisers wanted very targeted audiences. So suddenly that mass audience wasn't very valuable or as valuable to advertisers. So newspapers started charging their readers a lot more, and they found that the most dedicated readers were willing to pay a lot more. So the subscriber base, the amount that's coming directly from consumers, both people buying the printed paper and people paying for unlimited digital service, has grown for almost every regional newspaper at the same time that advertising is going down. So at some point, you know, those lines cross and you begin to make up the losses. But at this point, the combination of subscriber revenue and digital advertising still doesn't begin to make up for all the money lost in print advertising.
So I guess the question is, can newspapers survive long enough to finally feel that they can survive just with subscribers rather than advertising?
I don't think it's going to be a matter of surviving without advertising. I actually think in the digital age, particularly because of the intimate sort of relationship that readers have with newspapers, I think there's going to be lots of opportunity for targeted advertising and new sorts of business relationships that can be developed. But yeah, that is the big challenge. And I would say, you know, the question isn't can they survive, because they have to. They
right.
absolutely have to for our democracy. Not necessarily ink on paper, mm-hmm. but the idea of a collection of highly trained, sophisticated journalists working collaboratively and particularly working as watchdogs on the elements of power in our communities. We have to have that for democracy to survive. It has to happen on a local level. So the question is, how do we get there? I will say there are a lot of interesting developments and experiments going on around the country. One of them is right here in Philadelphia. Here, the paper, two major newspapers, the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News, have been donated to a nonprofit mm-hmm. Entity, and that nonprofit is raising money, tens of millions of dollars, and will be providing a resource for the newspapers to experiment and accelerate their transformation. So it will get there, but it's just a matter of getting from one side to the other. And you know, I would say to people in Seattle and to your listeners, you know, support the Seattle Times every way you can to help them get to the other side.
Well, it's interesting you bring up the question of ownership, because the Seattle Times is owned by the Bleden family. It's one of the last family-owned papers in the country, and you worked for them for decades. And I guess the question is, they're holding on to this newspaper. Should they be hanging on? Are there other ownership options that would work better for a newspaper like the Times?
You know, I really can't speak to what their resources are. I can speak to what their dedication is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what their dedication is a tremendous gift to the region in the Northwest. You know, they have a tougher fight because they don't have the same economies of scale that Gannett and some of the big chains have. At the same time, they have a lot more local knowledge, a lot more local commitment. I am confident in their resolve.
Mm-hmm.
I can't speak to whether ultimately their resources will hold out, but I'm certainly absolutely confident that they're going to do everything they can to make it work.
3 years ago, you were here at KUOW, and you gave us a vision for the future of newspapers. You said that you thought there would be a big, expensive printed paper edition on Sundays, and the rest of the week would be digital. Do you still see that as potentially the future of newspapers?
Well, I see it as a stage, and I don't see it necessarily as the universal answer. But you know, frankly, if I own the Seattle Times, it would be the model I'd be moving towards, particularly in a very wired city such as Seattle. I think a once a week high quality news printed paper that was filled with high quality investigative news, cultural reporting. Great writing, great photography, and great printed advertising, because the print newspaper can still be a really effective vehicle for certain sorts of advertising. I think that could be a really powerful product for which I think you could charge the exact same thing you do for the 7-day-a-week product and not bother putting out a printed newspaper, you know, ink on dead trees, printed on giant printing presses, loaded onto trucks, and delivered out to people's doorsteps every day. That seems to me to be an archaic business model that doesn't have a great future. And then really high-quality digital products during the week. Now, I would say as long as the Seattle Times is printing and delivering 7 days a week. Again, I think the readers and those who care about democracy and a free press ought to take it 7 days a week, even if they wind up not unfolding it, you know. But
yeah.
David, I think it's part of the commitment.
David, we're going to have to leave it there. David Boardman, executive editor and senior vice president at the Seattle Times. He's now the dean of the School of Media and Communication at Temple University in Philadelphia. David, thank you.
Thanks. It's been my pleasure.
And stay with us. We'll be right back with a conversation on the future of the state's Republican Party. This is The Record. I'm Deborah Wong. This is The Record. I'm Deborah Wong. Bond Huberman is here tweeting at KUOW. On yesterday's show, we had a spirited discussion about the future of the state's Democratic Party in the wake of the election of Donald Trump. Today, we consider the Republicans. It was a bitter, divisive, at times unpleasant primary season for Republicans. There was name-calling, there were insults. At times, the debate stage felt like a middle school cafeteria. But then Republicans nominated Donald Trump, and despite a lot of Republicans' misgivings, they catapulted him to the presidency. We're going to be talking with a group of Republican activists about that journey. But first, I spoke with Susan Hutchison, the chair of the state's Republican Party. She told me why Donald Trump didn't do so well in Washington state.
Definitely, it's because of Seattle, King County. That is the juggernaut we've got to get through with our presidential candidates every time. But we also perform very well. Donald Trump performed very well in the coastal counties, and that's the reason that we gained a House seat in a traditionally Democrat district. So Trump helped in that district to give Jim Walsh a victory.
Do you have a mathematical problem, though, in that you have such a big Democratic-leaning section of the state in Seattle and the metropolitan Seattle area, and that getting a presidential candidate through, or getting statewide candidates or U.S. Senate candidates through, is going to be next to impossible for Republicans?
Well, I don't think it's impossible. I think every year is new and different. And one of the things that's going to happen with Donald Trump as president is people are going to be seeing some solutions, Republican solutions to problems such as the economy, such as jobs, such as national defense and national security. And as time goes on and people begin to see the changes, I think that they will be more amenable to thinking about Republicans in a positive light. It's been 8 years of President Obama, and I have to be honest, I live here. In fact, I only live probably less than a mile from this studio here in the U District. And I've lived here for over 35 years. And there is a dearth of broad-based information being perpetuated in the city of Seattle. It's pretty much no breathing room here for Republican thought. And you ask any Republican in the city what it feels like, and every one of them thinks they're the only one. You know, none of us get to put up signs in our yard. Nobody gets to put bumper stickers on their cars because they know they'll be damaged or vandalized. And so it's that kind of, I always start out my speeches to speaking to Republican groups around the state as I live in the place where free speech is not free, because it'll cost me money if I put a bumper sticker on my car.
Literally? You've had your car vandalized?
Oh, absolutely. Mm. You've got to be so careful about how you express yourself.
In the interest of building empathy, again, today, what do you say to those folks on the other side who might be, I know there's a lot of concern among progressives about some of this, you know, white nationalism, you know, these folks on the fringes of the Trump movement who are now becoming emboldened, and sort of a rise in hate crimes, and the campaign was so full of bullying that this has become like the norm in political discourse now. So what do you say to folks on the other side who literally say, I'm scared by a Trump administration?
Well, I would say that right now, I believe Democrats are working through the various stages of grief. And the denial, the anger, all of those parts of the grieving process. I know the feeling. I am a Republican. And so not only was I particularly unhappy with the reelection of Barack Obama, I have been so dismayed at his policies. So I can understand that there are people on the other side of the aisle who have the same feeling and will continue to have that feeling about Republican policies that are passed in the next 4 years. I completely understand that. But eventually we have to let go of kind of the inflammatory rhetoric. And I would say that an awful lot of the stuff that's being said right now, the name calling and so forth about Trump and his supporters, it's out of bounds. It's ridiculous and it's false. So we are your friends and we are your neighbors, and we have a different way of believing that people can succeed in America. And so I look forward to watching the actions of our next president and those who surround him and being able to see a very positive move forward.
You're presiding over a party where there have also been pretty significant differences over during the primary process, and even continuing with, you know, many prominent Republicans saying they didn't vote for Trump, they don't support Trump. And I'm wondering, and you know, you've been a pretty loyal defender of Trump through the general election. Do you feel vindicated in a sense?
Well, the reason I would feel any vindication at all is on behalf of the people who chose Trump as their nominee. And that's who I realized. You know, I began to listen to the Trump supporters in the late spring, where I hadn't really before that. And I began to understand that their concerns for America were significant and that they represented kind of a gut level sense for the fears and concerns that they had for their world. And I do understand that there were some prominent Republicans in our state who were in that never Trump category. And I think that's one of the reasons why Trump performed so poorly, because I think there were a lot of Republicans and independents who may have chosen to vote Republican, but they were confused.
And what do you say to those folks who are, I mean, I guess Chris Vance has been on our air in recent weeks saying, you know, he doesn't feel like he has a home in the Republican Party anymore. So what do you say to folks like that who really feel alienated within your party by what's been happening?
People may not like Donald Trump's style, but they certainly, if they're Republicans, like some of the people that he's selected to surround himself with. And anyone who understands presidential politics knows you're not electing an individual. You're electing that person and all the people that they choose as advisors and cabinet members, who then go ahead and hire many, many more, hundreds, if not thousands of people to populate government. And so when I look at some of the selections that have been made by President-elect Trump thus far, I am really excited.
You're convinced that Donald Trump will win over these never Trump folks in the state?
I think he will. And it's not that, you know, we're not looking for a messiah as our president. We're looking for someone who can get the job done. And I think that Donald Trump has a long history of getting the job done. Now, some the ways he does things is a little confusing or even perplexing or concerning. But as I watch him work, I keep going back to that art of the deal. And I keep thinking, okay, if he actually is going to govern the way he does business, everything starts as a negotiation. And people should take heart in that. They will hear one thing, but they've got to understand that's where the negotiation begins.
A couple more questions. Are you considering a job in the administration, or are you being asked?
Actually, I think I would answer that the way everybody who is being looked at for any particular position, and I know that I am, I would say if the country asked me to serve, I would be honored to serve. As you know, I came from a military family, and I was a military daughter. My dad served for 33 years, and my husband also served for 30 years in the Marine Corps. And so it's in my blood to serve the country in whatever form I can. And so if Donald Trump asked me to serve in a capacity that was good for me and good for the country, I would definitely take a long, hard look at it.
That was Susan Hutchison, chair of the state's Republican Party, who says she is being considered for a post in the Trump administration, but she didn't say which one. We want to continue the discussion about the future of the state's Republican Party. And in the studio, we have three Republican activists who represent a diversity of views. Olga Farnum is a lifelong Republican from rural Snohomish County. She's a state committee woman and has been an alternate delegate to the last two Republican National Conventions. Manise Pierre is a small business owner and Republican activist. He's been a field organizer managing canvassing efforts for the party in North Puget Sound. And Braden Wilkerson has been a delegate to two Republican National Conventions. This year, he was elected on a Ted Cruz slate. He describes himself as a conservatarian, which I guess is conservative and libertarian. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, this was a very long campaign, lots of twists and turns and lots of bumps in the road. And I'm really interested to hear about your personal journeys through this past year. Olga, let's start with you. You were not an early supporter of Donald Trump.
No, I was not. I initially supported Marco Rubio. I kept some of my views to myself for quite a while. I am also the caucus and convention chair in Snohomish County, and I do the caucus training. So I tried to keep my preference to myself for as long as I could until I had to declare.
So Rubio, and then what happened when Rubio dropped out?
When Rubio dropped out, there were only, I think, Kasich and Cruz and Trump were the only ones left, and so I jumped on the Cruz bandwagon.
You went to the convention as a Cruz delegate, and then what happened?
Well, before we got to the convention, Cruz had dropped out of the race, and Trump had clinched the nomination.
But you had to be convinced to support Donald Trump.
Absolutely.
So what was the convincing process like?
Well, the convention had a lot to do with it. After listening to his children talk about their father and listening about how successful they've been, and I think it has a lot to do with the upbringing that they had, because children that successful who admire their father the way they do don't have a bad father. And then also listening to some of the people that worked for him. There was a woman who works at his winery, and there was a gentleman, he was Muslim, who was also involved with Trump's organization. And they were both very, very supportive of Donald Trump and his ability to succeed in business.
So your mind was changed at the convention?
Yeah, that was pretty much the turning point, yes.
And Manise, you also were not an early Trump supporter. And in fact, you didn't even vote for Donald Trump. What were your reservations?
Yeah, I left the presidential slot blank. I voted Republican down the rest of the ticket. As a Republican, I support the nominee. I've spent the last 3.5 years doing groundwork. Throughout the whole entire process, I kept my opinions to myself, given that it was my job to support Republicans. So, yeah, the president-elect is the president-elect, and I support him in his efforts and all that he does. The process from me not voting him in to where I support Trump has been one of just thought and considering the people that he has around him.
What did you not like about him initially? What were your reservations?
Several. I mean, given that my family is from Haiti and the uproar with all that.
Immigration policy?
Yes.
Okay.
And given his management style, at least what I understood his management style to be. That said, I've spoken to people who have interacted with him personally, and it's different. So I'm looking forward to the next 4 years to see what happens.
You're giving him the benefit of the doubt?
I am, but it's more than that. I'm going to place my trust in the process. I'm going to place my trust in the system. He is now the president. That's not going to change.
Braden, you were a Ted Cruz supporter. You were part of the Never Trump movement.
Yes.
Are you still part of the Never Trump movement?
I would say that I'm strongly Never Trump, and I've thought about this and how I would respond to this. This is been an ongoing question from personal friends, family, members of the media. And the best answer I can give you is that I don't vote for fascists. I've never liked racism. I've never liked misogyny. And I do not support authoritarianism. So for me, never means never, ever. And I don't care if he's president. I don't care if he's the Republican nominee. I am guided by my convictions and my conscience. And my sole allegiance is to the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and I think he is a one-man constitutional crisis. And that is just the way it is. And I think that there are enough Republicans who, if they examine their own history and their own personal battles with our nominee and our future president, I think that all of us have some serious reservations about his policies, his positions, his personal stances. And I don't think somebody's family, their sons, the people they surround themselves with change who they are as a person individually. And he's going to be president. I expect much more of the people that lead us. I think as conservatives, we expect the highest level of accountability from our elected officials, and I don't think he meets the standard.
Olga was telling me earlier that just watching his cabinet picks has made her feel better, has made you feel better about
yes.
anything that Donald Trump has done in the last month or so that has made you feel better or worse.
I think I'm probably with you here in that I hope he does the best, right? I mean, he is the president of the United States, and he's going to govern the country for 4 years. And so I think for all of us, we have to hope that he performs well, that the people he selects for the Supreme Court, the people that he selects to hold, you know, ranking offices, you know, in the executive branch, that those people do exactly what he said that he was going to do. And so in one sense, I do hope for the best because he is going to be the leader of the country. But I also think that we have to keep people accountable. I think dissent is the truest form of patriotism. And so in the same way that I would hold a Democratic president accountable to the Constitution, I'm going to hold Donald Trump as equally accountable, if not more so, because of my serious concerns and serious reservations about his previous positions.
Moniz?
For me, it's about trusting the system that's currently in place. I have faith in the role of the presidency and the Congress. I believe in America. And so in my faith, I don't see it getting out of hand as a you know, the sky is falling, the sky, because we have Trump. That doesn't make sense to me.
I believe in the process, too. I believe in checks and balances. I believe in limited government. I believe that our representatives represent us. But I also think that we ought to believe people when they say that they support internment camps. We have a process in place and it protects us, but we also can't ignore what people say and what they do in their lives and in their careers, especially when they're running for office and they're very open about their disapproval of certain segments of the population or their extreme views on torture or seriously, we're seriously negotiating and talking about whether or not we will illegally round up 11 million people, prohibit certain segments of the population from entering the country. We're seriously talking about internment camps, and you're going to sit there and talk to me as though that's a truly limited constitutional position. I don't know any Republican president who could find any of those provisions anywhere in the Constitution or Bill of Rights. I just don't see it, guys.
Well, you know, I've heard about the internment camps, and you know, I think that's overblown. You know, there's so much fake media out there anymore. And you know, I've experienced that with my family. You know, they come to me and they say, you know, because my family is chock full of Democrats, and they talk to me about, you know, as a Hispanic woman, I should be against him because he wants to deport all of the illegal aliens. I lived in a border town for several years, and I experienced illegal aliens in a very personal level.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you've lived it, you have a whole different perspective about illegal immigration, especially when you've got the criminals coming over, the drug lords. I remember living in El Paso, Texas, when they shut the border down because one of our DEA agents was exposed who had infiltrated one of the cartels. And they shut the border down because the cartel said, we're sending him back, but we're sending him in pieces. And you'll find him in the cars coming across the border. And as a Hispanic woman, you know, my family, some of my grandparents came from Mexico. You know, I just...
Do you think he's lying?
Donald Trump?
Yeah. When he says the things he says, you think he's lying?
Well, you know, he's a celebrity. I think sometimes politicians are always very, very careful about what they say.
Not Donald Trump.
But he's not a politician. He didn't come to us like Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. He didn't come up the ranks. He just came out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when my family gets angry at me about Donald Trump being president, I said, you know, I'm not the one you need to be mad at. You know, the people that elected him weren't so much us. I mean, Moniz himself said he didn't vote for him. I did. Wisconsin, Ohio, Minnesota, you know, the people that have lost their jobs and lost their families, those are the people that have said, we've had enough.
Moniz, I want to bring you into this discussion because you did tell me that immigration policy was one of the real hard things that you had in terms of deciding about Donald Trump. Your family is Haitian. You're from Haiti. What do you think when Donald Trump says we need to deport all the illegal aliens and that we need to build a wall? I mean, what was your reaction?
There's serious issues there that need to be addressed when it comes to immigrants, immigration policy, when it comes to how it's all dealt. Here in Washington State, we're kind of insulated from a lot of that. We're not next to the border. There's no Mexico or like in, down in Florida where my family is. There's no drug running up I-95 or anything like that. and we kind of live in our own little bubble, but it's a serious issue and we need to look at it differently. So my hope is that with everything that Donald Trump is saying, it draws attention to the issue. Should it be dealt exactly the way he's saying it should be dealt with? I don't know. I don't have all of the information. And I think it's ignorant for people to say that's not how it should be done. I also think it's ignorant for people to say that's exactly how it needs to be done. I think it's something that needs to be looked at. I think it's something that him and the people around him needs to seriously consider, because it's an absolute issue.
And there are laws in place that aren't being followed. There are illegal immigrants here who are criminal who are still walking the streets.
We're talking about the future of the Republican Party and the election of Donald Trump with three Republicans, Olga Farnum, Manise Pierre, and Braden Wilkerson. And I want to get back to kind of what this, all of this sort of dissension and division means for the party going forward. We have at this table a lot of different views about what should happen to the party. Braden, you were part of the Never Trump movement. Olga, you told me that you were really angry at the Never Trump people and
yes.
kind of blamed them for a lot of what happened.
It was very disappointing when Bill Bryant came out and disavowed Donald Trump. He was a fabulous candidate. He would have made an incredible governor. And I think he shot himself in the foot. So, you know, I think we hurt ourselves. And, you know, Susan often says, you know, that the Republican Party. Susan Hutchison. She calls us a patchwork quilt of ideas. And we are. You know, Braden, he's a man of conviction and he believes in his ideas. I am disappointed because as a Republican, I think we need to support our candidates. I voted for Chris Vance because I would prefer him over Patty Murray.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, my husband doesn't agree with me 100% of the time. I'm lucky to get him to agree with me 50% of the time. But we can be a patchwork quilt of ideas in the end. And the Democrats are very good at this. The Democrats in the end will stick together. Bernie Sanders came out and he was all for Hillary.
It's funny because the Democrats that we had at the table yesterday said the exact opposite. We had one person saying Democrats fall in love, Republicans fall in line. So in that respect, Braden, is there something to be said about that? Do you need to fall in line as a Republican at some point behind your presidential candidate?
I don't think so. And I think the strongest sort of under theme of who we are as conservatives, I think we are rugged individuals. I think that is probably the one thing that unites us all in the patchwork quilt, is that we believe very strongly that the smallest minority is the individual. And I think I really believe that dissent is truly, it's the truest form of patriotism. It's a long-standing tradition of our American values that sometimes you have to be guided by your conviction and your conscience. It's what we expect of our Republican representatives to sometimes be the no vote, the single no vote. And I think that that's sort of where I stand on this, is that I'm just not sold. I'm not convinced. And, you know, I hope the best, and I hope, you know, the best for all of us and for the country. We'll move on. We'll work together and fight together in legislative races and to try to take back the Senate and the House and do a lot of those things.
So the mantra for the Republican Party is often that you guys are a big tent, right? You have room for libertarians, social conservatives, Tea Partiers. You all fit under that tent. Is that really true going forward? Do you all feel like you have a home in this party? And I guess I'm looking at you, Braden, but do you all feel like you can bring all of these really disparate groups together, especially after such a really bruising election? Manise.
Because I worked on the ground, because I had to organize, I had to deal with all of the different people. And so for me, it didn't matter what my opinion was. It didn't matter. And so if we are Republicans who want success in the state, we have to reach the point in which we're willing to work together. Right. So if we were willing to work together, for instance, with the Bill Bryant thing, I understand that that is where Bill Bryant was at. But that ended up hurting us down ticket. And I don't like this phrase, but you got to fall in line at some point if you want to win. Otherwise, we end up in the same situation we have been. If you truly believe in the things that you say you believe in, then it's about success.
But for what purpose?
To better the state. Is that not what it is you're looking for? Are you not looking to spread your conservative ideals across the state?
Of course. But Donald Trump doesn't represent my conservative ideals.
I'm not talking about Donald Trump at this point. We're talking about just making the state where you live at home better.
I voted for every Republican on my ballot but Donald Trump.
That's good. Thank you,
Brady. Well, you know, we're going to have to leave it here, and I hope we'll continue this conversation. I'm sure we will continue this conversation about the future of the Republican Party. Thank you so much for being here, Olga Farnum, Manise Pierre, and Braden Wilkerson. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks. This is The Record. I'm Deborah Wong. It's The Record. I'm Deborah Wong. The Seattle Sounders have been in the MLS playoffs every year since they became a Major League Soccer team in 2009. They have never made it to a final. But that all changes on Saturday when they face Toronto FC on Toronto's home turf. And whether you've never watched soccer in your life or you rave green, we've got a preview of the upcoming game. Steve Clare is the owner of Prost America, a news site that's devoted entirely to soccer. Steve, last time you were here talking with Bill Radke, he asked you for your prediction on who would win the cup, and you said,
"As I don't know who the opponent is yet, I can't predict it. So you'll have to invite me back in a week's time to talk about the final, because I won't be able to duck it then."
Well, it's been a week, and we've asked you back on. So how does a Sounders-Toronto matchup look like to you?
Well, obviously, my ruse to be invited back on and get another segment on soccer worked beautifully.
Absolutely.
But as I said last week, we didn't know who the opponent would be. Now, I was on a Toronto show last night, and they asked me the same question. And my answer was, I'm not going to say one thing on a Toronto station and the other on KUOW tomorrow.
All right. Well, what did you say then?
My brave American soldier act was last night that I tipped Sounders to win. I think momentum is on the rave green side. And now I can breathe much more deeply and tell your listeners, I think Seattle Sounders will win on Saturday and bring home the cup.
Okay. So why do you think? I mean, is it just that you want them to win, or do you feel like they do have the edge?
No, the reason is this is based on emotion and logic. When you go into a playoff round, which is, you know, the norm in American sports, you need two things on your side, form and luck. Quality doesn't matter. How you played the rest of the season doesn't matter. Sounders approached the playoffs in form, as many of your listeners will know. They had a terrible first half of the season, then went 8 wins, 2 losses, and 4 draws in the last 14, or something like that. They had a bit of luck in their first play-in game against Sporting Kansas, where the referee was helpful. But since then, the form has been fantastic. The way that Coach Brian Schmetzer handled the two legs in Colorado was a masterclass for a guy in his first full year as coach. And I just think that form is on the Sounders' side, momentum is on their side, and I think this will be the year that they finally win it, despite obviously being the visiting team.
Okay, so this has been, as you mentioned, a pretty tough season for the Sounders. And, you know, the star Clint Dempsey was benched due to an irregular heartbeat. And Coach Siggy Schmitz, we said goodbye to him mid-season. So what happened? Like, how did this all turn around so dramatically for the team?
Well, there are a couple of theories that are popular, and I've got a third. One was that Ziggy had just lost touch with the team. They were no longer playing for him. The team didn't believe in him. And as time has come, it has to be said that the 11 players put out on the pitch are all people hired by Ziggy. So he just takes some of the credit for this. A secondary theory exempts Ziggy and says the arrival of playmaker Nicolas Lodeiro from Argentina was the big difference. And in fact, the Sounders parted with Ziggy the day before he arrived, presumably because they wanted to fire him before the guy arrived. I have a third theory that Clint Dempsey was the block, that he was underperforming and overpaid, and that really presented a team coordination and unity that has really been on show since he left. But I think most Sounders fans are not really of mind to finger point about what the change is. They're very grateful that it happened and have really enjoyed the run under Brian Schmetzer.
What do we expect from the team next year? What are you looking forward to?
Well, obviously, most people listening will look forward to parading the MLS Cup on the opening day. I will be looking for that Brian Schmetzer's honeymoon is not just a honeymoon, that he can carry on inspiring the team and having players play for him. Also, I think we'll be looking for more young players coming through. Sounders' pipeline has been not very good in the years they've been in MLS, but a young lad called Christian Roldan has come through, and second only to DeAndre Yedlin, has probably been the best player to come through the ranks. I think we'll be looking for more young players to come and show that they can at least challenge the first 11 for their place.
All right, so we have this tradition in Seattle of having lots of bandwagon fans come out of the woodwork when our sports teams are doing well. So if you've just started paying attention to soccer and the Sounders and you want to watch Saturday's game, what are some of the things that you should know that make you sound like you're not a bandwagon fan, that you've been a seasoned fan all along?
I would say don't worry about it. Don't pretend. When the Sounders were in the USL, 3,000 to 5,000 people came to watch, and it's now 30,000. It's been a gradually growing movement, and I would like to think that existing Sounders fans will accept you readily and want to educate you. So don't feel the need to mug up to impress people. Tell people you're new. Tell people that this season attracted you, and you'll be made welcome. Don't be false about it, and certainly don't worry about admitting that this season is what attracted you.
All right, well, we're looking forward to the game, and we'll talk to you afterwards, I hope. Steve Clare is the owner of the Prost America Soccer News site, which is devoted entirely to soccer around the world. They've just published a new book, the 2016-17 Women's Soccer Yearbook. Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
This is The Record. I'm Deborah Wong. Welcome back to The Record. I'm Deborah Wong. When you move into rental housing, you often have to pay for more than just rent. Many landlords charge upfront for stuff like first and last month's rent, security deposits, cleaning. Those extra costs are often called move-in fees and can add up to thousands of extra dollars. The Seattle City Council wants to change that. On Monday, they'll vote on a proposal to cap the fees landlords can charge and develop a payment plan for tenants who can't pay move-in fees up front. Brian Robinson says this proposal hurts many smaller landlords in Seattle. They depend on those upfront fees, and they're often the landlords who provide more affordable housing in the city. Robinson is a landlord himself and on the board of directors at the Rental Housing Association of Washington. Sochi Makovich is an organizer with the Washington Community Action Network. She agrees with Robinson that Seattle needs more affordable housing, but she says this proposal could help remove a barrier hundreds of people face when they try to rent, and they don't have thousands of dollars saved to pay upfront move-in fees.
Earlier this year, my organization did a survey of our members and of other renters in the city. We surveyed over 300 people, and 87% of those people said that the high upfront costs are a huge financial barrier to accessing housing, because the minimum wage right now, depending on where you work, in a couple years, it'll be at $15. The state minimum wage is going to be $13.50. But those wages don't mean that you can afford a $2,000 rental. And Zillow did a study earlier this year saying that rent is, in Seattle, average rent's $2,000. And when you're talking about having to pay a first month, last month security deposit and various fees, you're having to come up with thousands of dollars. And in this day and age, people have student loans, they have medical bills, they have kids to take care of, food to get. There's just a lot of basic necessities that are very expensive, making it really difficult to save up for these high upfront costs. And I've talked to a lot of people who are currently living in tent encampments, and there are many people who have stable incomes, like Social Security or even full-time jobs, but they can't afford to move into a rental. And so these payment plans, they make it possible for people to actually move into rentals. And I think security deposits and things like that make sense and are necessary for landlords. But because they're not typically used until the end of the tenancy, and it's really difficult to find housing anyway, so a lot of people, once they find a good deal, they're going to stay in it as long as they can. I think that this is a happy medium in helping people get into housing and addressing like real issues around making sure landlords have their security deposit and things like that.
A happy medium, you called this legislation, if it passes. Brian, what do you think about that, this idea of payment plans, of capping these fees? Does that sound like a happy medium to you as a landlord?
You know, it's really hard because I think I try to share the same goals and want to help everybody housing-wise and align with the values I see on the street in Seattle. But no, I don't see these policies as particularly a happy medium. They're pretty far over. And the biggest problem I have with these kind of caps, and also with just some of the other procedures that are happening in Seattle, one after another, is that the only place you can really find value housing right now is through small mom and pop landlords. this $2,000 a month average housing, it's because of Vulcan building new units in South Lake Union, and it's because of the tech community changing the landscape in Ballard the way they have. And so the smaller mom-and-pop units, people who own less than four units, those are the people who are providing the bulk of the value. And in this scenario, the problem is that the large property owners and managers and developers are going to be much more effective at vetting people. They're going to be much more effective at working around this legislation, and they're going to care less. So they are going to continue to have success. For the first time in my life, it's not just kind of a fringe group. Everybody, if you're a small property owner, you own two to four units, you're a little bit scared right now. You're scared that the policies are going to be something you don't know how to enforce. You're scared that if you make a mistake, you're going to be attacked or show up on the radio or referred to as a slumlord. So I think that the policies right now are awfully hard for the smaller people, and they're relatively easier for the larger companies, and that's just going to result in more property consolidation amongst the kind of big heartless organizations that probably should be paying this bill themselves.
I hear what you're saying, that in aggregate, it feels like a lot of smaller landlords are being affected adversely. But how does a cap on upfront fees like security deposits, how does a payment plan for security deposits, first and last month rent, how does that affect the landlords you're talking about? What would that look like?
Well, I think that people are going to struggle making necessary repairs to units because they're not going to get first and last, and there's going to be a cash flow issue, especially for smaller people. And I think that there's going to be a lot more default and a lot more damage. Again, you take a 20-year-old applicant who's fresh out of college and know nothing about them. It is illegal and not something I should do to say this 20-year-old doesn't look like they can afford a space to live. But in the new scenario, you cannot take source of income as a consideration. You cannot turn someone away due to age or appearance or anything, which you shouldn't be able to do. And you have to take them even if they don't have enough funds. So you're going to be taking people into your units who are going to have a higher percentage. A bad tenant in the unit can easily do $10,000 worth of damage, easily. And I think that you are going to see a lot of defaults. And when I say a lot, maybe 5-10%, not the majority, but they're going to be costly and they're going to be expensive. That's really the reason the city doesn't want to do this themselves. The easy answer would be for the city to impose a levy upon property owners and to use those levy funds to build affordable housing, to supplement rental payments for my fixed income tenants that really need the help, and to provide a bank for these move-in costs. There are many homeless agencies that do that, but they can't do it effectively because they can't recapture that money because they have a default rate. So I think what we would see if private property owners were doing it is that some people would be really good at the system and game around it, and other people would suffer the same problem that a lot of our nonprofits and city organizations do when they try to do the same thing.
Sochi, what's your response to that? The idea that this may create a system where some landlords get good at stepping around the edges and avoiding having to deal with this?
I mean, I think the thing to keep in mind is that everyone I know, everyone that I have organized, the first thing that they pay is rent. And so people are not trying to destroy where they live, right? They want housing. They want to be able to have somewhere to come home to because it's necessary for your health. It's necessary for your safety. Because we understand there's risk associated with renting, that's why landlords will still be able to ask for security deposits. They can still ask for last month's rent under this legislation. The payment plans are dependent upon the length of the lease. And so in my mind, this is very modest legislation. What this will do is it'll help people get off the streets. It'll help people get out of dangerous situations. I know someone who was in a domestic violence situation, but she could not save up enough money to get out. And it took her over 4 months to save enough money to get out of that situation. And if this legislation would have been in effect, she would have been able to move out of that in less than a month.
So then, Sochi, as our listeners think about this legislation, what is the one thing you want them to understand as the city council prepares to vote on this next week?
I think the thing for folks to understand is that the reason behind this legislation is the idea that housing is a fundamental right. It's a fundamental necessity that everyone needs. And in Seattle, we're failing to meet that. And so we need to find a way to ensure that people can access housing. And one of the ways that we can do that is by reducing barriers to housing. And one of the biggest barriers that hundreds and hundreds of people that I've talked to over the past couple months have cited is the high upfront costs that are required to get into housing. Because when you're talking about having to pay $6,000 just to move into a rental, you're on your way to a down payment for a house, you know? And people who are making $15, $20 an hour, like, that is so much money. One of the biggest supporters of this legislation is the Seattle Education Association, which is the union that represents teachers. Teachers are not minimum wage workers, but they're workers who can't afford to live in Seattle. And so the just most important thing about this legislation is that this will help so many low and middle income people access housing, and it'll help get people off the streets.
Brian Robinson, as listeners are thinking about this legislation, the fact that the city council will vote on it next week, what is the one thing you want them to understand about it?
If there's one takeaway, I think I'd like your listeners to understand that the people who rent them their homes are not one homogenous group. There are large businesses and small businesses. There are ethical practitioners. There are unethical practitioners. And at the end of the day, if there are 4,000 people sleeping outside in the cold, we need to make sure that there are 4,000 new units of housing to accommodate them. And we need to make sure as many of those people, the people who are operating those units as possible, are operating them in an affordable manner. So I would like to see regional policy come into a way that has carve-outs for small business, that supports and encourages the growth of small business, and that puts the cost of housing these four people onto some of the larger organizations that are really inherently causing this problem. And I would ask as a small business for the people crafting the policy to look specifically at how they can protect our existing customers and small businesses who are trying to continue providing valued housing.
That was Brian Robinson. He's a Seattle landlord, and he's on the board of directors at the Rental Housing Association. We also heard from Sochi Makovich, an organizer with Washington Community Action Network, and they were speaking with KUOW's Jeannie Andel. The Seattle City Council is scheduled to vote on the legislation to cap move-in fees on Monday. You've been listening to The Record. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Deborah Wong. Bill Radke will be back tomorrow. Stay tuned. The BBC News is next.